my pleasing duty as the chairman of this National Democratic Convention and its committee specially designated for that purpose, formally to notify you of your nomination by it on yesterday for the office of President of the United States.
Chairman Walsh, my friends of the Democratic National Convention of 1932, I appreciate your willingness after these six arduous days to remain here, for I know well the sleepless hours which you and I have had. I regret that I am late, but I had no control over the winds of heaven and could only be thankful for my Navy training. The appearance before a national convention of its nominee for president to be formally notified of his selection is unprecedented and unusual. But these are unprecedented and unusual times. I have started out on the tasks that lie ahead by breaking the absurd tradition that the candidate should remain in professed ignorance of what has happened for weeks until he is formally notified of that event many weeks later. My friends, may this be the symbol of my intention to be honest and to avoid all hypocrisy or sham. You have nominated me, and I know it, and I am here to thank you for the honor. Let it also be symbolic that in so doing, I broke traditions. Let it be from now on the task of our party to break foolish traditions. We will break foolish traditions and leave it to the Republican leadership, far more skilled in that art, to break promises. Let us now and here highly resolve to resume the country's uninterrupted march along the path of real progress, of real justice, of real equality for all of our citizens, great and small. Our indomitable leader in that interrupted march is no longer with us, but there still survives today his spirit. Many of his captains, thank God, are still with us to give us wise counsel. Let us feel that in everything we do, there still lives with us, if not the body, the great, indomitable, unquenchable, progressive soul of our Commander-in-Chief, Woodrow Wilson. I have many things on which I want to make my position clear at the earliest possible moment in this campaign. That admirable document, the platform which you have adopted, is clear. I accept it 100%. you can accept my pledge that I will leave no doubt or ambiguity on where I stand on any question of moment in this campaign.
There persists an orderly and hopeful spirit on the part of the millions of our people who have suffered so much. To fail to offer them a new chance is not only to betray their hopes, but to misunderstand their patience. To meet by reaction that danger of radicalism is to invite disaster. Reaction is no barrier to the radical. It is a challenge, a provocation. The way to meet that danger is to offer a workable program of reconstruction. And the party to offer it is the party with clean hands. This, and this only, is a proper protection against blind reaction on the one hand, and an improvised, hit-or-miss, irresponsible opportunism on the other. There are two ways of viewing the government's duty in matters affecting economic and social life. The first sees to it that a favored few are helped and hopes that some of their prosperity will leak through, sift through, to labor, to the farmer, to the small businessman. That theory belongs to the party of Toryism. And I had hoped that most of the Tories left this country in 1776. But it is not and never will be the theory of the Democratic Party. This is no time for fear, for reaction, or for timidity. And here and now, I invite those nominal Republicans who find that their conscience cannot be squared with the groping and the failure of their party leaders to join hands with us here and now in equal measure. I warn those nominal Democrats who squint at the future with their faces turned towards the past and who feel no response to the demands of the new time that they are out of step with their party. Yes, the people of this country want a genuine choice this year, not a choice between two names for the same reactionary doctrine. Ours must be a party of liberal thought, of planned action, of enlightened international outlook, and of the greatest good to the greatest number of our citizens. Now, it is inevitable, and the choice is not ours. The choice is that of the time. It is inevitable that the main issue of this campaign should revolve about the clear fact of our economic condition, a depression so deep that it is without precedent in modern history. It will not do merely to state, as do Republican leaders, to explain their broken promises of continued prosperity, that the depression is worldwide. That was not their explanation of the apparent prosperity of 1928. The people will not forget the claim made by them then that prosperity was only a domestic product manufactured by a Republican president and a Republican Congress. If they claim paternity for the one, they cannot deny paternity for the other. I can't take up all of the problems today. I want to touch on a few that are vital. Let us look a little at the recent history and at simple economics, the kind of economics that you and I and the average man and woman talk. In the years before 1929, we know that this country had completed a vast cycle of building and inflation. For 10 years, we expanded on the theory of repairing the wastes of the war, but actually expanding far beyond that and also far beyond our natural and normal growth. Now it is worth remembering, and the cold figures of finance prove it, that during that time there was little or no drop in the prices that the consumer had to pay, although those same figures prove that the cost of production fell very greatly. Corporate profit resulting from this period was enormous. At the same time, little of that profit was devoted to the reduction of prices. The consumer was forgotten. Very little of it went into increased wages. The worker was forgotten. And by no means an adequate proportion was even paid out in dividends. The stockholder was forgotten. And incidentally, very little of it was taken by taxation to the beneficent government of those years. What was the result? Enormous corporate surpluses piled up, the most stupendous in history. Where, under the spell of delirious speculation, did those surpluses go? Let's talk economics that the figures prove and that we can understand. Why, they went chiefly in two directions. First, into new and unnecessary plants, which now stand stark and idle. And secondly, into the call money market of Wall Street, either directly by the corporations or indirectly through the banks. Those are the facts. Why blink them? Then came the crash. You know the story. The surplus invested in unnecessary plants became idle. Men lost their jobs. Purchasing power dried up. Banks became frightened and started calling loans. Those who had money were afraid to part with it. Credit contracted. Industry stopped. Commerce declined and unemployment mounted. And there we are today. Translate that into human terms. See how the events of the past 3 years have come home to specific groups of people. First, the group dependent on industry. Second, the group dependent on agriculture. Third, and made up in large part of members of the first two groups, the people who are called small investors and depositors. In fact, the strongest possible tie between the first two groups, agriculture and industry, is the fact that the savings, and to a degree the security of both, are tied together in that third group, the credit structure of the nation. Never in history have the interests of all the people been so united in a single economic problem. Picture to yourself, for instance, the great groups of property owned by millions of our citizens, represented by credits issued in the form of bonds and mortgages. Government bonds of all kinds, federal, state, county, municipal. Bonds of industrial companies, of utility companies. Mortgages on real estate in farms and cities. And finally, the vast investments of the nation in the railroad. What is the measure of the security of each of those groups? We know well that in our complicated, interrelated credit structure, if any one of these credit groups collapses, they may all collapse. Danger to one is danger to all. And how, I ask, has the present administration in Washington treated the interrelationship of these credit groups? The answer is clear. It has not recognized that interrelation existed at all. Why, the nation asks, has Washington fail to understand that all of these groups, each and every one, the top of the pyramid and the bottom of the pyramid, must be considered together, that each and every one of them is dependent on every other.
This convention wants repeal. Your candidate wants repeal. And I am confident that the United States of America wants repeal.
2 years ago, the platform on which I ran for governor the second time contained substantially the same provisions. The overwhelming sentiment of the people of my state, as shown by the vote of that year, extends, I know, to the people of many of the other states. When that happens, with that, we as Democrats must and will rightly and morally enable the states to protect themselves against the importation of intoxicating liquor where such importation may violate their state laws. We must rightly and morally prevent the return of the saloon. Back to this dry subject of finance, because it all ties in together. The 18th Amendment has something to do with finance, too. In a comprehensive planning for the reconstruction of the great credit groups, including government credit, I list as an important factor that fine statement of principle in the platform, here adopted, calling for the letting in of the light of day on issues of securities, foreign and domestic, which are offered for sale to the investing public. My friends, you and I, as common sense citizens, know that it would help to protect the savings of the country from the dishonesty of crooks and from the lack of honor of some men in high financial places. Publicity is the enemy.
There emerges one great, simple, crystal pure fact that during the past 10 years, a nation of 120 million people has been led by the Republican leaders to erect an impregnable barbed wire entanglement around its borders through the instrumentality of tariffs, which have isolated us from all the other human beings in all the rest of the round world. I accept that admirable tariff statement of the platform of this convention. It would protect American business and American labor. By our acts of the past, we have invited and received the retaliation of other nations. I propose an invitation to them to forget the past, to sit at the table with us as friends, and to plan with us for the restoration of the trade of the world. Go into the home of the businessman. He knows what the tariff has done for him. Go into the home of the factory worker. He knows why goods do not move. Go into the home of the farmer. He knows how the tariff has helped to ruin him. Yes, at last our eyes are open. At last the American people are ready to acknowledge that Republican leadership was wrong
and that the democracy is right. My program, of which I can only touch on these points, is based upon this simple moral principle. The welfare and the soundness of a nation depends first upon what the great mass of the people wish and need, and secondly, whether or not they are getting it. What do the people of America want more than anything else? In my mind, two things. Work. Work with all the moral and spiritual values that go with work. And with work, a reasonable measure of security. Security for themselves and for their wives and children. Work and security. These are more than words. They're more than facts. They're the spiritual value, the true goal towards which our efforts of reconstruction should lead. These are the values that this program is intended to gain. These are the value are the values we have failed to achieve by the leadership we now have. Our Republican leaders tell us of economic laws, sacred, inviolable, unchangeable, that these laws cause panic, which no one could prevent. But while they prate of economic laws, men and women are starving. We must lay hold of the fact that economic laws are not formed by nature. They are made by human beings.
The federal government has always had and still has a continuing responsibility for the broader public welfare. It will soon fulfill that responsibility.
And now, just a few words about our plan for the next 4 months. By coming here, instead of waiting for a formal notification, I have made it clear that I believe we should eliminate expensive ceremonies and that we should set in motion at once. Tonight, my friends, the necessary machinery for an adequate presentation of the issues to the electorate of the nation. I myself have important duties as governor of a great state, duties which in these times are more arduous and more grave than at any previous period.
And yet I feel confident that I shall be able to make a number of short visits to several parts of the nation. And my trips will have as their first objective the study at first hand from the lips of men and of women of all parties and all occupations, the actual conditions and needs of every part of an interdependent country. One word more. Out of every crisis, every tribulation, every disaster, mankind rises with some share of greater knowledge, of higher decency, of purer purpose. Today we have come through a period of loose thinking and descending morals, an era of selfishness, of individual men and women, and of whole nations. Blame not governments alone for this. Blame ourselves in equal share. Let us be frank in acknowledgement of the truth that many amongst us have made obeisance to mammon, that the profits of speculation, the easy road without toil, have lured us from the old verity. To return to higher standards, we must abandon the false prophets and seek new leaders of our own choosing. Never before in modern history have the essential differences between the two major American parties stood out in such striking contrast as they do today. Republican leaders not only have failed in material things, they have failed in national vision, because in disaster, they have held out no hope. They have pointed out no path for the people below to climb back to places of security and of safety in our American life. Throughout the nation, men and women forgotten in the political philosophy of the government of the last 12 years look to us here for guidance and for a more equitable opportunity to share in the distribution of national wealth. On the farms, in the large metropolitan areas, in the smaller cities and in the villages, millions of our citizens cherish the hope that their old standards of living and of thought have not gone forever. Those millions cannot and shall not hope in vain.
I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people.
Let us all here assembled constitute ourselves prophets of a new order of competence and of courage. This is more than a political campaign. It is a call to arms. Give me your help. Not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America to its own people.